We acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which company has been recorded, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. We respect their continuing culture and the past and present contributions they have made to this region. You're listening to Company, the podcast connecting Australian artists, where we talk all things personal, professional, and spiritual. Joining you, as always, are your hosts, Georgia Kennedy and Tiana Catalano.
Welcome back.
Interesting.
I'm in a good mood today. I thought I'd just sing it.
Good.
Just sing it to the people.
Like that. Hey, welcome to our fourth episode of Company. We've got a fun episode today with your old mate.
Yeah. Our bonus episode is with my good friend, Lawrence Boxhall, who is just such a wicked person. And we went through high school together and, he kind of left when I was in year 12. For the majority of it because he was doing an ABC series. So he's been working and training and everything ever since we left, which was a while ago because I'm old. But, so the chat was awesome and I'm really excited for people to hear it. And sorry for being way too excited during the interview because I just get so excited when I see him. So there you go.
It was really nice to listen in. Y'all have nice chemistry.
Yeah. Well, we were Madame Thénardier and Thénardier in Les Mis. So you just can't break that bond. Yeah. Yeah.
Master of the house.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the keeper of the inn.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Damn straight. But before we jump into that, I think we might have a bit of a riff.
Riffy riff.
Of the week.
When are you ready?
Riff of the week. Riff of the week.
Okay, so I am so excited for this week's riff because Tay-Tay, T-Swizzles, has come back with the goods. She has come back with a stripped back album just like how she started, and my inner 12-year-old is super duper happy. And it's called Folklore. If you haven't seen it already, give it a listen. There is a song on there with Bon Iver in it, and it's just what?
Bon Iver.
That's what I meant. That's what I said. Yeah. But it is so good. I'm loving it.
It actually slaps. There are a lot of songs on that album that really slap. I think it's like the old Taylor Swift, but the production is a lot more advanced and her lyrics are a lot more advanced. And she's allowed to swear now in a lot of her songs.
Yep.
Which is great.
Love that.
I actually really enjoy it. I've been listening to it on my drives. I like it.
Yep. Love it.
Sorry, just to intercept into your riff.
That was my riff. Back off. But no, what's your riff then, Georgia?
My riff is also a new album that came out a few weeks ago, Leanne La Harvest's new album. I am her biggest fan and no one can fight me on that. I adore her. I've adored her for like 7 years now. I saw her when she came to Sydney and did a little concert like in the city. She's got her new album. It's been about 5 years in the making, so everyone is super stoked.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. My favorite song's probably Can't Fight, but the bass line slaps in every song. Her vocals, her vibrato is insane. I love her. I wish I was her. So everyone should go listen to her new album. It's just called Leanne La Harvest.
Lawrence Boxhall is a NIDA graduate who made his television debut in teen series The Worst Year of My Life again, and was in Michael Reimer's critically acclaimed Deadline Gallipoli for Foxtel, Matchbox Pictures, as well as featuring in The Spirit of the Game. Lawrence made his professional stage debut in 2015 opposite Jane Turner in the Melbourne and Sydney Theatre Company co-production of Jumpy.
He was the Gen Z captain in Channel 9's popular primetime show Talking About Your Generation, and is well known for playing the main cast role of Daniel in both seasons of ABC's Ronnie Cheng International Student. Last year, saw Lawrence star in Melbourne Theatre Company's enormously successful 2019 production of Shakespeare in Love, directed by Simon Phillips, and Padalog Theatre's production of Punk Rock.
Hello, Lawrence. Welcome to company.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, I thought we'd start off the podcast with any recommendations that you have for us, any like arts or TV recommendations.
Oh, golly. Right. Yes. Obviously, if you've, there's so much sort of great theatre that's accessible on terms of like streaming platforms now, which is, you know, super cool. Yeah. But what have I been watching? I recently watched this really great series called Flowers with Olivia Colman, which is this amazing.
I don't know it, but I love Olivia Colman.
Right?
To watch this. Yeah.
It's about this writer. It's the family, the last name is Flowers, and it's not spoiling nothing because it's in like the opening 10 seconds. The dad is suicidal. And it's this amazing look at this sort of family in crisis, but it's also really deeply funny and very dark. Mm. And not many people know about it. And it's pretty divisive. Like some people love it, some people hate it. I loved it. Yeah. I watched that recently. So if you've got some time on your hands, check out Flowers on Netflix.
Flowers. That's great. Okay,
done. It's on the list.
Nice.
Perfect.
On the list. Beautiful. With your growing up in theatre, because you came over to Australia in your teens, right? So you...
Early. I was like 10 or 11, I think.
So did you get to see a lot of theatre overseas?
I think the very first memory I have of theatre is not particularly great theatre. I lived in Germany and we would go and see plays locally in German, and my mum is fluent in German, so she would be like furiously whispering to us everything that was happening on stage, and my brother and I would just be like, there's a lot of color and movement, this is fantastic. But I actually know even when I lived in the UK, didn't get to see much theater because I was at boarding school. It was not we did school plays, and it was there that I decided that I want to be an actor. But I don't think I saw like my first West End production or anything like that until I came back to the UK after living in Australia for like 3 years, which was Les Mis.
Amazing.
Or Billy Elliot, one of them. Yeah. I think we came back and saw one of them. Amazing. So not really. No, it was all a bit later that I sort of got into seeing theatre.
Yeah. Amazing. And what would you say is the theatre experience or movie experience as well that really has moved you and changed you as an artist?
I was doing a production. It was my first show with MTC called Jumpy back in 2015, and we toured up to Sydney. And as a cast, like half the cast wanted to go see a National Theatre Life production of View from the Bridge, and it was directed by, I'm going to say his name wrong, Ivo van Hove, I think. I'm probably saying that name wrong. I think he's Belgian. And it had like Mark Strong and Nicola Walker in it. Mm-hmm. And I remember, because I was doing a play at the time, and my part had like six lines. And the rest of the time I was moving furniture. It was fantastic. And which really, like your first professional theatre gig, you don't want to be the lead. You want to be the person with six lines moving furniture because you learn so much. Mm-hmm. But I remember seeing this National Theatre Live recording of View from the Bridge, and I came out and it had just shifted everything. Like the acting was incredible. It was done in like, I think it was done in the round or like a thrust stage or traverse or something.
Yeah. And I think I know what you're talking about. It's like they had like basically a rectangle that had some seats along the side. So it was basically the in the round. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. It was that one. And like, if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to ruin it because it does pop up occasionally, but it's like the final image, the final beat is just, it just floored me. And I went, oh my God, that's what you can do with theatre.
Yeah.
I didn't understand. I didn't understand. It's like a born again Christian or something. I was just, it completely hit me. And that was, that stuck to me to this day. It's just like the most remarkable thing. I think I would have been 18 years old and I saw that, and it just, completely altered my perception of what's possible.
Amazing.
Yeah, I've seen that production and it's so good. Like that, so in that good. Last moment, you just see, because I just watched it on the TV at home and I was like, oh my gosh. Like I didn't know what to say. I was just like, Yeah. Incredible.
So on the flip side, what was your biggest theatre or TV mishap?
Ooh, that's a wonderful question. Well, touch wood, I've been fairly lucky so far where not a lot has gone wrong. I remember during the aforementioned Jumpy, we would have been on like the first or second week of performing down here in Melbourne. And my character was like the boyfriend to the lead girl in the play. And he comes on at one point, he's got this big fringe and he's got like a gym bag, like an over the shoulder gym bag. And it's like it's set at a picnic and they had this collapsible picnic table set up for the scene. And I had the gym bag and I had to stand in front of the table and you know, interact with Marina Pryor, who is just doing this burlesque routine. And she like pops a balloon with her thighs and she comes out and she's got like feathers on her nipple tassels and everything. It was hysterical. And then we kind of just lock eyes at the end. But I shifted on my feet slightly one night and I didn't realize that my gym bag had gone underneath the collapsible table. So when I shifted, it moved the collapsible table and it completely imploded in on itself. So, and on the table were like bottles of wine, grapes, chips, sandwiches, plates, cutlery, all the loud stuff. And yeah. It happened in such slow motion where it sort of folded in the middle and the wine went everywhere. And then as each leg individually collapsed in to return it to like its briefcase form of the table, the grapes rolled everywhere. And then the cutlery fell off with a clang and it was just like domino effect. And all of us were just standing on stage, just waiting for this cacophony to stop. Yeah. And underneath my giant fringe, my face was just going red. And I think the audience thought it was intentional because the timing of it was right. So sensational. But yeah, that was terrible. But also on that show, I was running late one day and I had a really shitty old phone and I couldn't call the stage manager because it wasn't, for some reason, just wasn't calling. And I was like legging it from Flinders Street Station to get to the Sumner Theatre. And I didn't realize that if all the cast members aren't there, you can't do the show. And like you can't even start the half an hour call. And so I was legging there and I was running really late and everyone was wondering where I was. And I came in and the stage manager, Jess, and I'm going to say her name, Jess Burns, because we're really close and it's fine. But she was so angry at me. Aww. And we did the show and I was so on edge. And then she came back and she just yelled at me and I was crying. And then she realized that she was, you know, she wrote me a lovely letter later. So I realized I was just like yelling at this, essentially someone who's still basically a child on their very first professional job. But then years later, I went to one of the first previews for Muriel's Wedding and they had like an audience component where they get audience members to go up on stage and be part of the wedding scene. And I was one of those people that, you know, went up. And so we had to wait backstage and I had to run to the toilet beforehand. So I was 1 minute late to going to wait backstage. And Jess Burns was stage manager of that as well. And I come backstage and she goes, "You're late again."
Brilliant.
I will never live that down. And she will never let me forget it. But other than that, I've been okay. I've been all right. Nothing too bad.
Yeah. That's great.
Table thing, that would have felt like the slowest domino effect ever as well. Like,
and no one could speak. I don't know. I think we were also aware of someone has to speak eventually, but every time someone went to speak, something else fell. So it was just sitting in the shit. And luckily it was interval right after that scene.
Okay.
So Stephen, the ASM came out and just was mopping up the wine and I was standing side to side. It's like, "I am so sorry." "Please don't fire me."
That's live theater, folks.
Yeah.
So good. Yeah. Amazing. So, okay. You, just to recap on your kind of journey. So you were in school and then you got onto an ABC TV series.
Yes.
And then you did some MTC and then you decided to go to NIDA.
I sure did.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah.
So you already
yeah.
had a career and then you decided to go back and study. Why?
Yeah. I don't know. So I was, so in year 12, I got my first, it was my very first professional gig was this ABC, three BBC, co-production. And it involved me taking like 4 months out of year 12, to go and do. And then after that, I did like a Foxtel series and the MTC. I did Jumpy and then shot a pilot for a series called Ronnie Chang. And I did like a small part in a feature film. And then I was hit with absolutely, I guess it'd be just sort of debilitating anxiety about, I lost all confidence in myself. And, you know, my relationship ended that I was in at the time ended in a fairly horrible way. And I was, you know, super heartbroken and despondent. And I just, everything kind of hit sort of a boiling point, this climax. And I realized, I don't know my craft. I'm just getting these jobs based on luck. I don't know what I'm doing. And one day, and then the imposter syndrome hit, and one day I'm going to be found out and I'm not going to get work anymore, which is, I think, everyone who gets imposter syndrome. So even when you get into drama school, you go, oh no, I shouldn't be here. They're going to find out one day that I'm crap. And, you know, and that all kind of hit at this 3 week bracket, everything hit. And my agent said, you know, if you want to go, then I understand and I support you. I don't think you should go. And everyone was telling me not to go, but you know, I live the punk life, and as you can tell, it was really spur of the moment. I remember calling up NIDA office because the applications had all closed, and I remember calling them up and asking, you know, do you have any spots free to audition? I'd auditioned for NIDA. It wasn't my first time. I'd auditioned for NIDA at the end of year 12, so I'd already shot Worst Year. And that was yet to come out, but I auditioned for NIDA and Whopper. I didn't get a call back for either of them. I didn't even get to do my second piece for Whopper. So I knew the process. And I remember calling up NIDA and they said, yeah, we've got like a couple of spots left in Adelaide, which is where I'm from. So I thought, obviously that's great. So I flew back and I had like a week to prepare. And so I didn't put much, it wasn't like something I was really kind of longing to do, because if I was really longing to do it, I would have prepared more. But as good fortune had it, I got in. And so it was a case of just really not thinking things through, really. Essentially doing everything very spur of the moment, which I highly don't recommend doing. If you have any interest in getting into drama school, do actually prepare. I think I just got in because I cheated the system a little bit, which I'd be very happy to talk about and ruin how I cheated the system. It was a really big decision to put a career on hold, and a career that in hindsight, you know, it's hard without sounding big headed, but it was going well. Like I was spending very little time unemployed between jobs, which I realize is incredibly fortunate. And I was in a very privileged position, against a lot of sort of my peers, and one thing was leading to another very nicely. And so it was very difficult to, there's no right way. There's no correct way. You know, you think, okay, well, I could not go to drama school. And 2 years from now, I don't have any training. I could keep learning on the job, or I might not. And then one day I have no training to fall back on, in which case I would need to go to drama school anyway, probably. Mm. Or I would keep learning on the job and I wouldn't need to go. Or I go and I come out of drama school and I try and slot back into where I was. Or I go to drama school and I come out and I never get a job again. There's no right way to do anything. So I just sort of thought, sod it.
Yeah.
And I just did it.
Just followed your gut, I guess.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Whether it was right or whether it was wrong, I don't know. I still don't know.
Well, I think it's worked out pretty well for you.
Well, this is the thing. The jobs that I've got post NIDA are very little to do with NIDA. So,
right.
Like, like I did Shakespeare in Love last year, and that was, I think, largely, and I won't speak to the casting process because I don't know what they were planning or what they were thinking, but I think it was largely because I'd auditioned for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and I'd done lots of callbacks for that, which was the same casting director as MTC, so she'd seen me recently, which I didn't get through NIDA. I got that through my agent because I maintain my agent through NIDA. So yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things that I'm sure in 20 years I'll look back and have some sort of extreme clarity on it. But yeah, that's a very long-winded answer, but yeah.
No. But do you think that you may not have had, because you love text. I remember us having a conversation about
your boy text, loves
and
words.
I was just sitting there just like, whoa, because I hadn't even like got to drama school yet. And I was like,
I remember working with you on your audition monologues. And you remember you came to NIDA and we sat in that room and like we broke down Shakespeare. Yeah.
And I was just like, this is blowing my mind and I don't really get it. But hey, made it eventually. But like your appreciation for text and all of that kind of stuff that you now hold so dearly to your work, do you think you would have had that if you didn't go to drama school?
Ooh, again, you know, who knows? Because like there were some, I'm not sure whether this is the time or place to go into a deep dissection of the politics of the NIDA that I was at. I believe it's a very different place now already, because I went through at a time of huge staff change and curriculum change and everything like that. So, but you know, certainly, because there are things like my voice training now, you know, our voice coach, Katerina, I shouldn't call her a coach, voice teacher, out of, you know, respect, was marvelous. And like the voice training we got in first year was like, it was invaluable. And because I remember on Jumpy, the play I did the year before NIDA, Pamela Rabe, the director, who is a fantastic actress and a fantastic director, but just about one of the scariest people I've ever met in my entire life. She looks at you and she sees your soul. And, I had six lines and she couldn't hear me. She was always, my one note always was, Lawrence, ping it up the back, ping it up the back. And then, you know, for Showcase, she came and saw Showcase at NIDA and she could hear me at the back. And I was like, yep. Got it. Yeah. There we go. Solid. I've appeased Pamela Rabe. I'm very happy. So, you know, things like that. And then things about the text, like I've always been very interested, even pre-NIDA in classics and Shakespeare and things like that. But I got an understanding of it at a much deeper level. But, you know, there are masterclasses where you can learn this stuff. You can get private tuition. I think back in day, possibly drama school was the be all and end all. Because you also, like in the UK, you had a rep theatre. So you would go and you'd become part of a rep theatre and you'd learn, you know, seven plays at a time or whatever and tour them around. But that doesn't really happen anymore. But, you know, Ian McKellen, I don't think he ever trained. And now he's like he's the font of all knowledge when it comes to Shakespeare. You can learn just on the job. You can learn. So whether I would learn it, I think I would have. I do in clarity, in hindsight. I think at the time when he applied, I thought no. But now, I mean, Tom Hardy never graduated drama school. Michael Fassbender never went. Toni Collette never. She left after first year NIDA. There's, you know, some just fantastic actors that did never go and have these incredible understandings of their craft.
Yeah, I think it's a thing of, when you are auditioning for drama school and then when you get there, you think it's the be all and end all and it's this big thing and it's such, you know, such an amazing experience. But once you get there, you realize it doesn't matter as much as you thought it did. And as corny as it sounds, like the friendships and what I've learned from other people is what I'm going to take away the most. I know that sounds so corny and like, totally. Oh, my great friends.
And even moving away from home and like just becoming a person is, I think, the biggest thing that I'll remember from drama school.
And learning to, like, my biggest learning in third year now has been learning to separate myself from the performer. And if I stuff up as a performer, it doesn't make me a shit person. Like, I'm still like a whole human outside of performing.
Yeah.
And I didn't, I thought they were correlated for 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You are not your work.
Yeah.
And It sounds like the simplest thing to say.
Yeah.
But it sometimes you really just have to wade through utter shit in order to find it. And sometimes you've got to spend 3 years learning how to breathe again, learning how to do all the stuff, to actually have these sort of small epiphanies, which are small, but they sort of all form the whole and they inform the whole. And definitely.
Yeah. Amazing. So one thing I wanted to talk to you about as well is social media.
Yeah.
And we want to talk about it because it's coming up more and more that we as artists are needing to develop these really strong, popular social media forums for ourselves to get work. Essentially, that's kind of the thought process that our students are going through, but also new people coming into the industry. But me knowing you and, you know, being in cahoots with each other, you don't really use social media for your work. Can you talk about that and whether you've had pressure from your agency or any other kind of experiences to push your social media presence?
I'm very lucky. I've got a very cool team behind me. My agent and publicist are very, very cool, and they totally respect my decision, or at least they tell me they respect my decision. Behind the closed door, they might be holding up their middle finger to me and screaming my name. But no, they are wonderful, and they've never pressured me to do anything about that. We've had very frank discussions about it, and so I've never felt pressured to do it. But I've never been interested in it. Even before becoming an actor, I was never interested. I never had Twitter. I never had Instagram even before, you know, even like in high school. I have a Lawrence Boxall official page on Facebook, which I use to promote work as I'm doing it. I don't use it for anything other than that, really. I wrote my first non-work related thing on there recently because it was really funny. I'm going to tell it now because now I get a large platform to do this. So yeah,
do it.
Here we go. Get ready for a joke. So I understand, job keeper and job seeker, but why isn't there job beater and job chaser? To me, all Quidditch positions matter. Oh,
yes.
Got it. There it is.
Oh, wow.
Hashtag follow me at Lawrence Boxall.
We'll be putting the link on the bio.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
But you know, I look at, it seems like a recipe for misery, really, social media. I don't know anyone who's happy on it. Genuinely. I know that sounds macabre, but I don't know anyone who sees it as something they enjoy doing. And this may come back around to bite me squarely in the posterior, in the future, you know, where, you know, if I lose out on jobs, and I'm sure I've lost out on jobs because I don't have a social media profile. I just don't care about it. I chat to my friends who are, you know, use it a lot, whether it's Instagram or TikTok or Twitter or whatever. And in order to build their brand and their image. But I'm of that old school belief of the less you know about an actor, the more you'll enjoy their work. The less you see of someone's private life, the more you can believe them when you see them do something, because then you're not projecting what you've seen on there. You know that they were in a bagel house in South Melbourne, and now you're seeing them on stage. Well, you know, they're in a bagel house earlier. You know, that's not it's just about trying to strip back the suspension of disbelief, essentially. Because of course, you know, they're actors, but you want to be able to, you don't want to be thinking about whatever scandal they're involved in or what they tweeted about or whatever, what they were doing or where they were, which some people agree with, some people don't. And I think it's telling when you have celebrities coming off social media, and particularly celebrities involving in the arts, you know, singers or dancers or actors, and they're coming off it. Because like we were saying, you know, you're trying to separate yourself from your work. But when you start forcibly blending yourself and your work, how can that be healthy? You know?
Totally.
Once you are actively blurring the line between yourself as a human being and then you as a creator and then you as a product, because ultimately this is an industry and you are a product. That just doesn't seem like a particularly fun thing to me. And you, like I said, you know, I'm sure one day I might get a job or lose jobs based on it. But like, we had someone in our third year at NIDA come and speak to us about the importance. And that was quite scary to me, that we had someone come and talk about how important it is to start working on your brand now, start marketing yourself now. And I honestly, I just don't want to. I would rather just work on me as me and work on the craft and just do my best to be a good person and let that try and speak for itself, rather than an Instagram post or publicizing something good I've done, or as in like a something not necessarily work, but you know, just like, hey, look, I donated here or something, or I helped clean up this, just as opposed to just publicizing it, just do it and be happy that you've done it. And then, of course, you've got the negative feedback. It just, it allows a gateway into your mind and your ego. And because we're performers, that's all very fragile at the moment anyway. So, and I got a job based on the fact that I didn't have social media. I did a television series called Talking About Your Generation on Channel 9. And we did 2 seasons of that. And one of the big reasons I got that was because I was this Gen Z who didn't have social media. That's weird.
Right. Yeah.
And it got me a job. So hashtag no regrets.
Yeah. And I think that's a scary thing coming out of a institution, is that you do have to sell yourself as like a product.
Yeah.
And there's not so much freedom to, you know, be really strong in your choice not to be on social media or sell yourself as a certain image.
Yeah.
Like I feel a lot of, like, I'm like, am I going to sell myself as the blonde? Do I have to be the blonde? Like, that's not what I do. That's the color of my hair. But there is this pressure when you're coming out and selling yourself to an agent that you need to be seen as that person. So it's crazy. And who knows if it can really change, but it's amazing that you were able to just, you know, you've got your art and that doesn't change whether you've got social media or not. It's still your work. So
well, it's like, you know, you never want to be typecast in your roles, right? So why would you typecast yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had the same chat at Brent Street, you know, what's your social media looking like? What's the quality of your photos and all of that kind of stuff? And I think it's a really dangerous rabbit hole to go down. I think there needs to be a separation of that for sure.
Yeah, it's tricky. Like going into showcase at the end of the year, I'm going, do I sing the ethnic song and then I'm, you know, typecast as the ethnic girl, or do I like not sing it and then hope that people will see me for more than that? So it's tricky, but I really commend you not, you know, sort of falling into the trap or standing your ground and saying, no, this isn't what I want to do. It's not going to fulfill me. It's not going to add any value to my life to be on social media.
Yeah.
And you are so sort of grounded in your work. And because that's another thing, I feel like the work can speak for itself. Like you don't need social media or other things to sort of speak for you. Whereas maybe some artists do need a mix of that.
Maybe. Yeah. I think it's entirely, and like, of course, I'm coming from a point of extreme privilege here where I have very little to sort of fight against. You know, I don't have to market myself to try and bend any sort of stereotype. That is a point of extreme privilege for me to be able to not have to worry about that. So I'm not sure. I don't, as a person of color, like how active do you sort of find yourself, like you mentioned, like thinking about that in terms of your showcase, but knowing that on your social media, the moment you graduate, and even probably now people are looking through it and looking through all your previous posts and everything that you are yet to post. How does that like for you when it comes to like, again, branding yourself or typecasting yourself? Like how you, do you think about that much?
In terms of my social media, not really. Like, I guess I'm quite political. Like, I guess that you would, you know, assuage that I'm a quite a left-wing person who, you know, showing up to the protests, and there's a lot of things that I actively care about, and that's sort of more what I post about.
Sure.
Are you on private as well? Like, your account is private?
Yeah, I think it is.
So I think that's another thing, like whether you have it, because I have it public, so I very much have had those thoughts.
Yeah.
And I have completely scrapped a lot of the older posts from when I was younger, because I'm like, well, that's really not going to help me.
Yeah.
You know, like me taking a photo of my sandwich when I was, you know, 17 is not really great for a professional page.
There is a filter that you definitely have to go through before you post anything. So it's never really truly authentic, I don't think, especially when you know that you're about to market yourself or get out there in the industry. You need to be careful. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So would you have like a public one? You have your private one, but would you then have a public one? Like once you graduate?
I might put it on public.
Okay.
Yeah. And then delete things as I go, or, you know, try to monitor it a bit more. But yeah, I also think, I don't know, it's tricky because you want to show who you are, and if an agent isn't going to take you, or if a casting director isn't going to look at you because of a post on Instagram.
Yeah.
Then do you want to
be doing that work?
Working with them anyway?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Is it that much of a missed opportunity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? 100%. Yeah. If they're not thinking about you as the craft person. Well, and the final thing I'll say on it though is like, you have so many studies coming out all the time saying how unhealthy it is for your mental health.
Mm.
And it just, in terms of interacting with each other as human beings, as creatives, we are trying to absorb and reflect and show and hold a mirror up to, I hate that phrase, but you know, we do. And like, I have friends going, oh, did you see my Instagram story? And I go, no, because I don't do this. And then it forces them to tell me about what they did in person, as opposed to just finding out about it through an Instagram story, which I just think is a point of, in these desperate times, these fractured times, a point of lovely human connection.
Yeah. Mm. So what do you, because it's so bad that I get to the point where I wake up and the first thing I do is like, I check my phone and get on my phone and check what's going on. So what do you do in the morning? Like, what do you do to sort of nurture your soul? As
I put on my pants one leg at a time, just like everyone else. What I do is I wake up and I just kind of lie there for, you know, 5 minutes, just sit with my thoughts for a little bit, register the day, register how I'm feeling. And then I just kind of get going. I don't check the news. I don't check my phone until usually after I've had breakfast or something. Just kind of sit with me, just see how I'm doing. I don't need to know about how anyone else is doing right now. Like, I'll just take that 20 minutes just for me.
Yeah.
And just, you know, it's such a lot, you know, imagine you wake up and the first thing you do is find out about how everyone else is doing and the terrible things going on in the world. That's like going from sleep to bombardment in like 20 seconds. So that's, you know, I just kind of a little bit of a tortoise morning, just slowly, slowly.
No, that's perfect.
That's awesome. And it's kind of scary that I don't even remember a time where I didn't get up and check what everyone else was doing. It all started with MSN. Where are you? What are you doing? You know, see you at school today. You know,
we're always got to check my Bebo.
Has anyone given me love on Bebo today?
Is it bad that I don't know what Bebo is?
Maybe it was an essay thing. Maybe a young thing. Yeah.
No, I know people who had it in Darwin.
Really?
Darwin,
it was like a profile. It was kind of like a MySpace, but a bit more like
a bit more emo girl.
Yeah.
Right.
But you could give love to one person a day, and I would pray that the boy I liked would give me the love, and he never did, but I always gave it to him. So I must have seemed like a crazy person, because every day I'd give it to him and he never gave it back.
That's because I didn't have Bebo, Tiana. I don't. How could I? You don't get it.
I know. I understand now. Miss times. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up a little bit because we could literally talk forever. Maybe we'll do a second episode. Who knows? But we would love to ask you, now that you've been through all the things you've been through and you decided to go to NIDA and all of that stuff, is there any advice that you would give Lawrence, who was at school or was first starting out in the professional world, that you, now being through everything, would say to him?
It's all gonna be okay, kiddo. No, I would probably say don't be afraid to say no.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are certain things, and not necessarily creatively, even just like, you know, there are, you know, developments or projects or meetings or people that you feel compelled to hang out with. There's all kinds of facets to this job that you feel that you have to jump on absolutely every single opportunity. And I would encourage young Lawrence to, yeah, make the most of most opportunities. And you, I remember, you know, at drama school, we were told to like make the most of every opportunity. And sometimes making the most of all opportunity is actually passing it by, because that opportunity could be detrimental. And sure, you could grow from it, but also you, sometimes you don't need damage. You can go through life without getting stabbed in the head with a spear and you're absolutely fine. But yeah, that, you know, breathe, young Lawrence. I mean, there's all kinds of things, but yeah, I'd probably just say, just take your time. There's no rush. Yeah. And that's probably my advice to young Lawrence.
I love that. I love that, because a lot of people say, take every opportunity, like don't waste anything. Yeah. But you need to reflect and go, oh no, this is the time where I need to say no.
Yeah.
Like deep down, sometimes I could do it and I already know it's not going to benefit me.
Yeah.
And it's not what I actually want to do. So I don't have to say yes. I can just let that one go and I'm probably better off for it. I think that's really good to keep perspective of like, you can say no.
Take obligation is a really dangerous spiral. It's, you know, you once you get into like, you feeling obligated to do something and you start sacrificing, I'm not saying by any means, you know, be a complete hedonist and screw everyone else. I'm out for me and me only. Certainly not advocating that. That's bad. but just, you know, sometimes you just need to sit with yourself. And this is the most hippie I've ever sounded in my life. But it's important, yeah?
Yeah, it sounds like you're kind of saying as well that you don't need to be a people pleaser so much.
Yeah.
Because I feel like as actors, we feel like we need to try to people please and please everyone and do everything. And that just is impossible. You run
yourself
into the ground to do that.
Everyone. And gosh, you know, the moment I think again, that ties into social media. You can't please everyone all the time. The moment you open yourself up to everyone, you're going to upset someone, surely.
Definitely.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
I love that. Lastly, where would you like to see the Australian entertainment industry in the future? Where do you want to see it grow?
With more Lawrence in it.
Everyone needs a little bit more Lawrence.
A little bit more Larry. Obviously, you know, like, I'd love to see, more diversity for the start. More incorporated diversity, of you know, things like Top End Wedding. You know, did you see the Top End Wedding when it came out?
No.
Miranda Tapsell film. It's just fantastic.
Yeah,
it's just marvelous. I just thought it was could rave. I'd love to see projects that. Really, I have a big gripe with Australian film and TV. I'm going to go on a quick rant here. I want to see Australian film and TV start producing more stories that could be set anywhere. So, for example, like there's this amazing, I think it's HBO miniseries called The Night Of with Riz Ahmed and John Turturro.
Yeah.
which is a remake of a British series, I believe, with Ben Whishaw. And it's this incredible story that doesn't necessarily have to be set in the United States. I mean, that story could have been told in Australia. So why aren't we producing more stories that could sell overseas? Because I think a lot of Australian film and TV is dripping in Australiana and language shots of the outback or, you know,
every war thing is like, you know, the spirit of the Anzac and mateship and all this kind of thing. And I'd love to see stuff that is just really, really good storytelling. And I think we are starting to see it skewed towards that, but it's taken a bloody long time of just really to start funding quality scripts with quality actors in them that can then sell overseas.
Yeah.
As opposed to making, and I find that particularly with a lot of Australian plays as well. A lot of Australian plays are locked in. They're writing, they're responding to something in the moment. So they don't age well. So if you're writing about a very specific time period or a very specific location, 20 years on, it's very hard for an audience that didn't live through that to respond. And then it becomes hard to like readapt or put on again. And you go, well, this is actually just really dated. And I find that with a lot of Australian film and a lot of Australian theatre against, you know, a lot of British and American stuff. And I'm not poo-pooing Australian film and theatre. You know, there's lots of stuff I do enjoy. But I think there needs to be writing about grander themes as opposed to a microcosm, which then can't be sold anywhere and other people can't enjoy it. And then 5-10 years on, you can't even enjoy it, as opposed to something like more accessible themes. And, you know, then that goes back to diversity. You know, you can have an Aboriginal story. You could have like a Shakespearean Aboriginal tragedy, because guess what? They are people too, and they experience loss and grief and betrayal. And so why aren't we writing stories about that? That would be, to pardon my French, fucking fantastic.
Yeah,
that's where I'd like to see it go.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
What an amazing answer.
Yeah.
To that.
So good.
And actually, I couldn't agree more. And with the diversity, less ethnic people playing ethnic roles. Like,
God, yeah. That's what I meant by like incorporated diversity. Yeah. Of course, you know, and again, I'm a white person speaking this, so I won't go into too much because it's not my place to say. But I did read a really interesting article, and I wish I could remember who it's by, but about not making a big deal of it. Like, of course, you need to make a deal of it in order to get the ball rolling. But then, you know, it shouldn't be a big deal, rather, as opposed to not making it shouldn't be a big deal that, you know, you have Black or Asian or Aboriginal people playing leads or not playing the ethnic best friend or, you know, playing doctors or scientists or whatever, just doing it. That's where I'd love to see. I'd love to end up at a place where it's so fucking normal that no one thinks twice about it.
Yeah. Mm. Amazing.
Love that. And
we can dream.
Right. Make it happen. Now, just before we go, future projects. What are you doing?
Future?
What should we be keeping an eye out for?
Oh, well, if all goes well, I'll be back at Melbourne Theatre Company later this year with a production of As You Like It at the Sumner Theatre, directed by Simon Phillips. That'll be on, hopefully, September through October, I believe, possibly November, depending on, you know, how things go, but it should be around then. I've been a busy bee lately. I've been narrating some audiobooks.
Oh, yes.
I've got about 10 audiobooks that'll be coming out soon. Most of them are kids' books. So if you have kids or you are a kid or you know a kid in a legal sense, then don't just give them to random kids because that would be weird. And I don't want to be attached to that.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And then at some point, come see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I was so excited for that. I was trying to work out whether I could go and see it.
It was pushed back because of the pandemic. But so at some point in 2021, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in Melbourne.
Amazing.
Which is going to be a razzle dazzle good time of theatre.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I can talk about.
Amazing. Yay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
for talking to us.
Letting me ramble. And very long answers to your questions. I'm so sorry.
It's good though. It's really good.
Awesome.
It's food for thought.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Love food. Yeah.
Absolutely. I love food so much.
So lovely to meet you and chat with you.
So lovely to meet you too. So lovely to see human beings.
Yes. Mm.
Oh, I just love him. He's so funny and so inspirational. Do you reckon?
Yeah, no, I do. I love him now too.
Yeah.
It was lovely to chat to you. Absolutely.
I love how he just sticks to his guns. Like he just doesn't care what anyone else thinks. And the most important thing is his art. And I just, I'm so inspired by him.
Yeah. I really want to meet him in person now.
Yeah.
Have a coffee and a chat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's just so passionate and always doing stuff. And I'm so, so keen to listen to the audio books.
Yeah. That sounds really fun.
So good. Children's so books. Good. But we hope you guys enjoyed that. And, you know, it's a bit of food for thought, social media and what the role it plays, you know, for Absolutely. Us as artists. So, yeah.
Love it. Thanks for joining us this week on Company. If you enjoyed this episode with Lawrence, please let us know on our Facebook or Instagram at Company Pod. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can find Lawrence on his Facebook page, Lawrence Foxall.
Big shout out to our producing guru, Douglas Rintel, media queen Deirdre Koo, also known as Deedle Dumb Designs, and David Dukeris on music. Catch you next time.
Bye.